God's children and throw it to the dogs. The Samaritans call the Jews call Samaritans dogs. And Jesus, was Jesus a racist? No. But what do you, what, you know, one thing, this is a message for the contemporary church and contemporary America. If racism is wrong, okay, and Christians should oppose racism, but if our opposition to racism is more important to us than Jesus is, we are idolaters. Abortion is wrong. We should oppose abortion. But if the abortion issue is more important to us than Jesus is, now Jesus may call you to devote your life to opposing abortion. That's fine. But if you make abortion, the abortion issue, more important than Jesus is, that's idolatry. If anything's more important to you than Jesus is, that's idolatry. So he was testing this lady to make sure. You say you're trusting in me for a healing. Are you willing to trust in me so much that even if I call you a racial slur, a dog, will you still trust in me? So he said, why should I throw the food for God's children to the dogs? And she responded, even the dogs are allowed to eat the crumbs that fall from the children's table. And then he healed her and then turned to the Jews and said, why can't I find faith like this among the Jews? But he really clear, the gospel came to the Jews, when they rejected it, it went to the Gentiles, and that's the thing, you know, don't throw your pearls to swine, but Jesus is also the type, if the sheep don't want it, sheep don't want to come to the wedding feast, the Lord will turn swine into sheep and bring them on in, but whatever the case, testimonial apologetics, psychological apologetics, what I mean by this is dealing with issues of man besides his thinking abilities, besides reason, okay, the will, the emotions, our desires, our thirst for meaning in life. By the way, I have a whole I have a section, I believe, three chapters on psychological apologetics in my first book, The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence. Probably the greatest psychological apologist who ever lived was Blaise Pascal. But one chapter is on man's thirst for God. You can find, even when you look at atheists and you read their writings, you can find there's a thirst for something more, a thirst to transcend our earthly experience, okay? And you can argue that it's a thirst for God, that all men have this thirst for God, this need for God, and everything that man needs exists, okay? I mean, a guy could die of thirst, but water does exist, drinking water does exist, okay? A guy could die of starvation, but food does exist. And if there is this universal desire for God, then that seems to be more than a desire. It seems to be a need. And so you can argue for God's existence from religious need. So from man's thirst for God, that would be one type of, one way to use psychological apologetics. Another one would be the absurdity of life without God. Okay? You take God out of the equation. That's what the book of Ecclesiastes is the oldest written form of the argument for God's existence from the absurdity of life without God. Solomon looked at everything under the sun and it was useless. It was vain. Everything was striving after the wind until he puts God in the equation. Once he puts God in the equation, then even the little details of life take on eternal consequence, take on eternal significance, I should say. Psychological apologetics. Another aspect of psychological apologetics would be, again, we're dealing with the will of man, the emotions of man, the desires of man. the fact that man and Blaise Pascal were going to champion this. By the way, his Pensées, I don't know if you guys have read his Pensées, but they're just diamonds. If you want an introduction to him, all right, do you guys have this book? Okay, I've got a chapter, the overview. I don't have to, no longer in print. We're going to try to...
Got the Pensées. It's not in order, is it?
No, because he died at age 39. Blaise Pascal, one of the greatest scientists who ever lived.
He just opened his
one of the greatest mathematicians who ever lived. He was only 39 years old. He was younger than me when he died. And he accomplished that much. But he had all his notes where he's going to defend the Christian faith. Pensées is French for thoughts. And he died, so they just put them together. He had his wager for God. You know, a lot of people think that Pascal's wager for God's existence, a lot of people say, oh, it's not valid, it's not blah, blah, blah. Well, keep in mind, Pascal is the guy who wrote the laws of probability. Pascal was a Christian. He was not a betting man, but he was the world's foremost expert on what a good bet is. Okay? And he said, basically, and we'll have time to go over that as we go into it. I go over that this with my 11th graders in the Christian Worldview course. We just draw a diagram of Pascal's wager. You wager on God and He exists, you win everything. If you wager on God and He doesn't exist, you lose nothing. You cease to exist like the non-believer would. But if you wager against God and He doesn't exist, you win nothing. But if He does exist, you lose everything. So because of the risk of losing everything and the possibility of gaining everything, the wise man will always wager on God. That's why Pascal said there's only two kinds of people that can be called wise. Those who serve God with all their hearts because they know Him, and those who seek for Him with all their hearts because they don't know Him. As far as Pascal's concerned, you're not a wise man if you're not looking for God just because of the possibility of infinite loss or infinite gain. And whereas if you don't seek, even if you win nothing. I would add a seventh branch, and it isn't in your notes there. The seventh branch that I would add would be what I would call cultural apologetics. Cultural apologetics. This is a lot like testimonial apologetics, only it deals with entire societies or cultures. And you say, what kind of worldview was behind the Nazi society, the Nazi movement? And you find it was basically a resurgence of ancient pagan myths. And you can make a case, well, therefore, we should think twice about embracing the New Age movement, which is a resurgence of ancient pagan myths. You could look at the millions, hundreds of millions of people that were slaughtered by Red China and the old Soviet Union. Well, what was the worldview at the base of their government? Atheism. So you can make a case that atheism really isn't a good worldview to build your government. You could look at India. India has what I would call an otherworldly pantheism. Hinduism is a pantheism, belief that God is the universe. God is this impersonal force. God is the universe. But the emphasis in Hinduism is on future incarnations. So if Carlito's suffering, I wouldn't alleviate his suffering because he's working off negative karma. If I alleviate his suffering, now he's got to be reincarnated to work that off in the next life. So you get nothing but neglect in India, okay, because nobody wants to interfere with anybody's negative karma. So just let the nice thing you can do for a suffering person is let them suffer. That's why the hospitals in India are built by the Christians. Why people like Mother Teresa, who was at least a nominal Christian, had to go into India to take care of the Indian people, because the Indian people were primarily influenced by the Hindu religion with the vicious caste system that you couldn't leave your caste and all. But the pantheism of the Nazis I would kind of call it a semi-pantheism that they held to, and the pantheism of the New Age movement is not an otherworldly pantheism where you get nothing but neglect. The emphasis is not on future reincarnations. The emphasis is on this world. The emphasis is on ushering in the New Age, the next stage in the spiritual evolution of mankind, bringing that in the here and now. And when you view all of mankind as God, it's like we're one big tree or one big plant. What do you do with the dead branches that refuse to acknowledge that they are God? You cut them off to enhance the growth of the whole tree. So that's why Barbara Marks Hubbard, a leading New Age thinker, she looks like a gentle grandmotherly figure, but she's calling for the extermination of one-fourth of the people on the planet Earth. What she's talking about is serious traditional Jews, Muslims, and Christians who refuse to acknowledge that we're God. You know, the two things that traditional Jews, Muslims, and Christians agree upon, there's two things we agree upon is these. There is a God and we are not Him. Okay? And with Shirley MacLaine, you know, she wants to stand on a beach and say, I am God, I am God, I am God. You know, obviously God's probably sitting on the throne laughing up a storm saying, no you're not, no you're not, no
you're
not.
Or like what Woody Allen said, which was I think the best line Woody Allen ever said. See, look at that. Even your guru has to go use the restroom. He's coming out of an outhouse. He's showing this young lady, you know, see, even your guru has to go to the restroom.
Woody Allen is actually, he's Jewish by nationality, but he doesn't acknowledge the Jewish faith, doesn't acknowledge God's existence. He's an existentialist. So if you do watch any of his movies, which I don't really recommend, I still watch as a non-believer, but if you do watch him, Tom Mars, our Notre Dame philosopher, is a big Woody Allen fan, and he'll bring up in his writings. He even wrote something like The Meaning of It All or something like that, where he wrote a commentary on Pascal's Pensées, and he brings up a lot of Woody Allen, some of the things he said. But some of the things that Woody Allen said in some of his movies, and when he goes home, he's part of a Jewish family, and he tells his mom and dad he no longer believes in God. The father's on the toilet, you know, he's in the bathroom. The father's in the bathroom, the door's locked, and Woody Allen tells his mother he no longer believes in God. So she starts throwing a fit. She says, I don't remember the names of all, but she says, Harry, Harry, your son no longer believes in God, and stuff like that. You know, and so then Woody Allen says, if God exists, how do you explain evil and human suffering? And so the mother runs to the bathroom door, knocks on the bathroom door, and says, Harry, tell your son how we can explain evil and human suffering, and how God can coexist with evil and human suffering. And the father from the bathroom yells out, Ethel, how am I supposed to know? I can't even fix the toaster. And so Woody Allen has these little philosophical things. In fact, one of them, in Annie Hall, he threw in a line at the end of the movie where he had broken up with Annie Hall and he wished he hadn't, and but life goes on and you know and stuff. And so he quotes from Groucho Marx, probably just meant it as a joke. Marx wasn't an existentialist. An existentialist means that a secular existentialist means that they reject belief in God, but they acknowledge if there is no God, then there's no meaning to life. Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, two French existentialists.
Camus, yeah.
And
his words I've read. Yeah. I remember these.
Yeah. Camus in the play, what he's arguing in that novel is that most Christians don't understand how strong his argument is. His argument is that we have to be like the atheist doctor tries to heal the sickness of the people who are suffering from the plague, but the priest says, look, don't fight the plague because it's from God. Now, a lot of Christians say, well, God didn't send the plague. We rebelled. The plague is sin. We rebelled, so God just allowed it. But they're underestimating the force of Camus' argument. Because Camus is saying, yeah, but even if God allowed it, since he's all-powerful and all-good, he has to allow it for a greater good. So the priest is not just saying, you know, we can't fight the plague because God sent it. He could say, even if God just permitted it, he could have prevented it. Since he didn't prevent it, he must have good reasons for allowing it, a greater good. And so by us fighting evil and suffering, we might be interfering with God's greater good. So we should just sit back. Now, what is the response to that?
Is the fight what we're supposed to get out of the place?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Excellent, Matthews. One of the greater goods that God brings out of suffering is he wants people who seek him to join with them in this cosmic battle against evil. And so, and after saying that, I think we can then turn the tables on Camus and says, and to tell him, now why in the world would your atheist doctor, what incentive whatsoever does he have for healing the sick? I mean, Albert Camus has gone on record saying the only question that philosophy has to answer is why not suicide?
Yeah, he argued against suicide, though.
But he admits, if there's no God, why don't we just kill ourselves? That's the whole issue of philosophy. Why do we go on living if there's no meaning to life? Well, you know, and so he's saying, well, you know, as an existentialist, you've got to take a leap of faith, you got to make meaning for your life, and this atheist doctor does it in his novel through fighting the plague, fighting evil, but the fact of the matter is, he could have went around capturing rats and sneaking into homes and throwing them into people's beds so more people would get the plague, and he would have been actualized. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre admitted that much, that whether you help the elderly lady across the street or you mug her and steal her purse, either way, you've actualized yourself. You've given meaning to your life. So in a world without God, moral values, truth gets thrown out the window, meaning gets thrown out the window. So once you take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm, you know, one guy wants to heal the sick, another guy wants to kill the sick, or kill the healthy. I mean, it's all, anything goes.
Every time I read his book, he was like, why don't you just believe? But he's known for, well, he grew up in like Algeria or something, he grew up with the poor, and he helped them.
Yeah.
And he dug on, set up stuff to help them and all that stuff, and you read his words, it's like, goodness, it's like he wants to believe, what the heck holding him back? And
Sartre worked with the French resistance during World War II and then was captured and was in, and put in one of the concentration camps of the Nazis. And so a lot of their thought came from their experiences. Obviously, existentialists are saying experience is more important. Experience is more important to find... experience is more important than reason in their views and all. But with the cultural apologetics, Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis are two of the greatest cultural apologists of the last century. The cultural apologist, C.S. Lewis looked, I believe it was a math textbook, don't ask me how, but I believe it was a math textbook, grammar school textbook, and C.S. Lewis was asked to critique it. And he found that they were teaching moral relativism in it.
Oh, it wasn't a math book. It was an English
book. English. Okay, good, good. I stand correct. So it was an English book, and it was actually teaching moral relativism. This is in his Abolition of Man.
He called it the Green Book, because he didn't want to get the title.
Yeah. And in fact, I was almost going to say, I think the author's name is Green, because I knew he's had Green in there somewhere. But what he argued for in that book, C.S. Lewis, was that... if we're going to teach moral relativism, and in subtle ways so the kids don't even know this is what they're being taught, if that's what we're going to do to the leaders of our future, eventually we're going to have to come up with the men without chests, basically human beings without moral consciences. We're going to reach the point of the abolition of man. Science, he says, is very close, the very thin line between science and magic, argued C.S. Lewis, because both magic and science tried to control nature. Now, in the process, science does stumble onto truth. So it is a means through which we can find truth, but there also is this aspect very similar to magic where you try to control nature. Lewis argues the last thing in nature that science will control is man himself. And so he argued that through, by teaching moral relativism, eventually we'll reach the point where the few will control the billions, where morality will be thrown out the window. And instead of morality being based on God's laws, instead of the laws being based on man's laws, being based on God's laws, the laws would be arbitrarily made by the government to protect themselves, people in positions of power. And so he was predicting a 1984 Orwellian society, basically if Western culture doesn't return back to God. Francis Schaeffer responded that way when he was responding to B.F. Skinner, a behavioral scientist, who's a materialist. B.F. Skinner believed only matter exists, so we really have no free will. All the decisions we make are based upon chemical exchanges in our brain. So everything is biologically predetermined. Okay? So then B.F. Skinner argues, therefore we need to get beyond concepts like freedom and human dignity, and man is controlled by his genetic makeup and his environment, his upbringing, the people he meets, where he lives. And so B.F. Skinner says that the intellectual elitists like himself need to control, do away with freedom and control the masses through genetic engineering and controlling their environment and move the world towards a better future, And so Schaeffer responded to it in a book, Back to Freedom and Human Dignity. And he argued against that, but he referred to it not as the abolition of man, but as the death of man. And though Schaeffer and Lewis don't even mention Nietzsche,
I think
it fits right in. I presented a paper before the Evangelical Theological Society where I tied it all together. The paper where I entitled Approaching the 21st Century, the Death of God, Truth, Morality, and Man. Nietzsche, as an atheist, thought that the death of God, truth, and morality would lead to the Overman, the next stage in human evolution. Lewis and Schaeffer saw the death of God would lead to the death of man. And by the death of God, Nietzsche didn't mean that God was alive once and then he died. What he meant to the concept of God, the Christian religion was the driving force of Western culture, and now it ceased to be the driving force of Western culture. And he was one of the first atheists to see the repercussions of that, the consequences of a world without God. And he predicted the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, and it was. But if Lewis and Schaeffer are correct, if Western culture doesn't repent and turn back to the God of the Bible, or at least back to his moral values, then the 21st century, the 20th century is the tip of the iceberg. As hundreds of millions were slaughtered by totalitarian regimes, godless regimes in the 20th century, billions will be slaughtered in the 21st century if Western culture doesn't start moving back in the direction of God. That's what cultural apologetics is arguing, is that the Christian worldview has a salvific, a saving effect on a culture. Okay? I will argue this, too, that and I think there's a book that I might write someday. What does it take to save a soul? Save a soul from damnation, what does it take?
Working the Holy Spirit.
But as far as, you know, what has to come about for a soul to be saved?
Well,
it
changed, right?
Well, it's through faith in Jesus. Okay? I do not believe for a culture to be saved or delivered or basically sustained, I do not believe that you have to have the culture, Christianity has to be the predominant religion. I do not believe that's the case. But what there has to be is respect for God's laws. And not just respect by the people for God's laws, but even the government respecting God's laws above. For instance, when God's telling the Israelites, in Leviticus 18, when you go into the promised land, don't perform homosexual acts, don't sacrifice your children to the god Moloch, don't be adulterous. If those things become widespread, it will defile your land, and I will vomit you out of the land just as I vomited the Canaanites out of the land. Well, the Canaanites were non-believers, they were pagans, but because they disobeyed God's moral laws, it destroyed their culture. Moral relativism, the moral relativism, the skepticism of the ancient Greeks led an ancient Greek philosopher named Thrasymachus to the conclusion that might is right. If there's no such thing as right and wrong, in the end, whoever has the most power rules. What that means, and I believe we can build a cultural apologetic on that, what that means, what Thrasymachus is saying is, if there's two guys in this room and one is bigger and stronger than the other guy, the bigger and stronger guy can force his will on the other guy. There's no such thing as right and wrong. You just force your will on the other. So power rules.
Evolution.
Survival of the fittest with evolution, exactly, a modern comeback of it. But then if four more weak guys walk in the room, now there's five weak guys, now they can overpower the big guy. Okay? So, but it's still, might is right, because now the strength is in the numbers. So now the big guy gets a pistol. And now he's in charge again. But now the five guys go out and get pistols, and now they're in charge again. So, I mean, it's not necessarily physical strength, it's not necessarily... You know, it could be who has the most weapons, who has the most money, or whatever, but in the end, might is right. Well, there were these three Greek dudes that showed up on the scene, one after another, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, that didn't bring Christianity into Greek society, but they basically were instrumental in saving Western culture from destruction, from the might is right ideology of Thrasymachus, by basically reintroducing God's moral absolutes into the picture without even realizing that they were God's moral absolutes, okay? The sad thing is our modern Thrasymachus, Friedrich Nietzsche, taking the survival of the fittest from Darwin, said that all that's left, since reason and morality have been thrown out the window, well, if God is dead, you see, Nietzsche argued that all that is left is man's will to power. The sad thing is, as Lewis, Schaeffer, the great thinkers of the 20th century, only had a small impact. They impacted millions of people, but there's billions of people living today. We have not had somebody to bring Western culture back to God's moral values. We haven't had a modern Socrates, Plato, or Aristotle. And to this day, the reigning influence, the trend is to go closer and closer, further and further, deeper and deeper into Nietzsche's will to power. And that's what postmodernism is all about, is power narratives. And forcing, in the religion of tolerance, becoming so intolerant that you force your politically correct views on everybody else. And
it's a dogma to follow for a lot of modern people, because they've been there. There's something wrong with them, and they want want assistance with it. So it's easier for them to say
control their life, control others.
Yeah, and it's when reason, it's like J.P. Warren said, when reason is thrown out the window, all that's left is shouting. And whatever the case, this all would be classified as cultural apologetics, arguing along those lines. And you can go through history and give solid examples that when you turn your back on the God of the Bible, or at least turn your back on his moral laws, and your culture starts saying, Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. When you start calling the good evil and the evil good, and that becomes prevalent in your society is just about to explode. Okay?
And Bobby Zacharias, too.
Yeah.
They're switching it from the conviction. The conviction is not just on the person who is the victim, or it's also the poor guy who committed the crime when he's...
And Ravi Zacharias is very strong on psychological apologetics and cultural apologetics, which were two of Francis Schaeffer's strengths. So, But where are you getting cold in here?
No.
The bathroom's in there, and it's all piled up.
Oh, no. The bathroom's over there. I was wondering why you were walking in the closet.
I was like, oh, I looked in there. I could see a leak in the back.
Yeah, and I think that's a play thing for the kids. They have a little kitchen play thing. But yeah, I was wondering, why is Carlito getting up and walking into the closet? But whatever the case, So those are basically the three different methods of defending the faith. I come at it more from a traditional method, though I do kind of overlap with verificational apologetics. I do respect what the presuppositional apologists have said, and someday we'll get a chance to talk about them as well. But the seven different branches of apologetics I would see as seven different areas of ammunition that we can use in the battle for the souls of men in our apologetic endeavor. Now, what we'll talk about next week, we just open it up for any questions or comments, discussions here. I don't want to get right into Phidyism. We were supposed to talk about Phidyism today, but basically all we did was just define apologetics and try to describe it by going over the three different methods of apologetics and the seven different branches. And so next week we'll make a defense of the whole apologetic endeavor by arguing that Phidyism is not a biblical concept, that the idea that you just believe totally apart from reason or you believe against the evidence, that is not scriptural. In fact, it's much, much more common with Hinduism than it is with true biblical Christianity. So we didn't actually even get to Phidyism today, so we'll talk about that next week. So at this point, we'll just open it up for comments, questions, or we could just, kick back and shoot the breeze about the Mariners or something, but whatever. But if we start talking about the Mariners, I'll turn the cassette off. But if anybody has any questions or comments, bring them up.
Like the Calvinists, they believe, Eugene Candy, he takes the position of, we're Calvinists. We know, God's already chosen, he's going to go to heaven. Mm-hmm. But he mentioned that most of those are do they agree mostly with 5-point Calvinism, or they go stronger for 5-point Calvinism? Because, some Calvinists argue, but he said, why bother preaching or sharing the gospel when God's just going to touch those or open the eyes of those who are already saved? But D.J. can't take the stand up. No, let's spread the gospel, because we don't know who's going to be saved.
Yeah, R.C. Sproul, the way R.C. Sproul puts it, he's a 5-point Calvinist. He got it from John Gerstner.
Oh, he's a great guy.
His Willing to Believe, his book's Willing to Believe, Chosen by God, a lot of his current books really bring it out, but he's always been a 5-point Calvinist, or at least since his seminary days. But John Gerstner is a former professor, but he's the kind of Calvinist I can live with, because he has friends who are non-Calvinists, and he doesn't condemn us to hell. But there are Calvinists out there who are coming very close to condemning us to hell. But whatever the case, I'll put it to you this way, though, too. You can make a real good historical argument against 5-point Calvinism. Because if, a lot of Calvinists will say Calvinism is Christianity. And they mean one of two things by it. They either mean, if you're not a Calvinist, you're not saved. Or there are some that will say Calvinism is Christianity, like R.C. Sproul. But what he means is, if you're a Christian and a real Christian and you're not a Calvinist, you're just an inconsistent Christian, but you're still a Christian. Okay? But the fact is, if the apostles believed Calvinism is Christianity, then they sure didn't get that point across to the apostolic fathers, their best pupils that they chose to lead the early church. Because those guys, when they erred, they came down heavy on the side of free will. I mean, so heavy that some were, moving in the direction of Pelagius. Of course, it was before Pelagius was around. But it was Augustine that was really, I think, the first hardcore Calvinist. Actually, Calvin was Augustinian, is the proper way to say it. But Luther was Augustinian, too. But the fact of the matter is, I think there are three things in his life that, and it would be the genetic fallacy if my entire case was based on this, that arguing just because his beliefs may have come from that, therefore they're false. But you just look at the historical situation of Augustine. Number one, he came from the Manichaean heresy, which was a fatalistic cult, that man was not free. So that was one factor. Second factor, he had to justify infant baptism and baptismal regeneration, that you baptize infants and they receive saving graces at baptism when they don't even know right from wrong. They don't even understand the gospel message. And so it was easy for him to say, well, God saves us totally against our will, so he forces us into heaven, so infant baptism and baptism of regeneration is scriptural. But there's also the Donatist heresy, where the Donatists refused to join the Catholic Church, or refused to stay in the Catholic Church, and so the Catholic Church was forcing them at the edge of a sword to convert to Catholicism. And Augustine had the miserable task of defending that practice, and he defended it by saying, well, God forces us into the kingdom, and the church is the instrument of God on earth today. We represent God today, so it's not wrong for us to force people into the kingdom. So I think he had some incentive, certain incentives to take that kind of stance. But before Augustine, I don't see any evidence of it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Calvinists would prove me wrong. But I don't see any evidence. In fact, most Calvinists, like Louis Burkhoff, openly admit in his History of Christian Doctrine, openly admit that before Augustine, what is today known as Calvinism did not exist. And now he would claim, you find it in Paul. Well, if you find it in Paul and the apostles, they did not make it. It was just a minor detail to their soteriology, their doctrine of salvation, because if it was the major thrust of it, they did not get that point across to Clement, to Rome, to Polycarp, to Ignatius. These guys implied from the start, salvation was through Christ. But even justification through faith alone, although I believe that was always the Bible, man is saved only through trusting in Jesus. The fact of the matter is, the first time you find that doctrine fully portrayed is Martin Luther. So I wouldn't, I'm not going to throw the first 1,500 years of Christians all into hell, but, we were saved solely by trusting in Jesus, but nobody spelled that out in a systematic way until Martin Luther. So I do appreciate our Calvinist brothers and sisters who will say you don't have to be a five-point Calvinist to be a Christian. But I believe the scriptures are really clear. I believe in the scriptures that God calls us to preach the gospel. See, Gerstner says we preach the gospel because God commanded us to. Even though, I don't mean to be a reverent, but I Calvinism reduces the gospel to the gospel of God zapping.
Sure, yes.
God either zaps you or he doesn't.
And
our preaching and our defending the faith is, to a large degree, just a side note.
It's really
not instrumental.
Yeah.
And they would say it's not futile because God commanded it. But my response would be, why did God command it? In other words, is salvation Jesus dying on the cross for our sins and God pleading with us to trust in Jesus for salvation? Is that what salvation is? Or is salvation just God's eternal election and everything else, including the death of Christ on the cross, almost a play being acted out, but in the end it's all just that election? And I believe God did elect us in eternity past, I even believe that God predestined every single detail of things that will occur. But my understanding of predestination is that predestination is not mutually exclusive with free choices. So in other words, we can all say that we came here today because we freely chose to come here today, but we could also say we came here today because God predestined that we would be here today. In other words,
with more knowledge than almost foreknowledge.
Well, but it goes even beyond foreknowledge. It goes even beyond God passively foreknowing what would occur. See, God's the one who determines how much oxygen is in the Earth's atmosphere. None of us, we didn't have any say in that, okay? So God did more than foreknow that we would freely choose to be here.
He allowed for it.
But he also predetermined that there'd be enough oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere so that we would be alive to, after freely choosing to be here, that we would be alive long enough to get here. So even though we make free choices, big deal. I mean, God, okay, I freely chose to accept Christ at age 21. But God had to predetermine that I would be alive at age 21 to freely choose Him. So it's basically, it's called Molinism, middle knowledge, where, you know, if just one of us freely chose not to come here today, and every other factor was identical to this actual world, it would be a different possible world. Okay? And so you've got like this infinite number of possible worlds that God could have actualized. But the fact of the matter is, He actualized this possible world, not another one. And so basically, God foreknew the future free choices we would make given certain circumstances. You know, I got taken out of New Jersey via the United States Marine Corps and brought to Washington before I freely accepted Christ. If I stayed in New Jersey and didn't go in the Marine Corps, I don't know. I might never have come to Christ. So God knew what circumstances would persuade me to freely accept Christ, so He foreordained those circumstances, brought those circumstances about so that I would be where I would need to be to freely accept Christ. But I do believe that those who end up in hell would suffer from what I would call, what William Lane Craig calls, trans-world damnation. In other words, there was no possible world where they would freely come to Christ. And now the thing is, why does God actualize? Why does God make some vessels for dishonor and other vessels for honor? Why does He actualize the existence of those who would reject Him when He knows they're going to reject Him? Well, every one of my descendants, to get the genetic combination that came out to be Phil Fernandez, and of course there's more than just the genetic combination, there's a soul, but I inherited that soul from my parents too, I believe. But to get Phil Fernandez necessitated that all of my ancestors, their existence would be actualized. Well, let's say 95% of my ancestors are going to go to end up in hell. For God to want the maximal number of people who freely choose to accept His Son and end up in heaven, if that is the greatest good, it would also necessitate the minimum number of people in hell. And in other words, now the minimum number of people in hell might be a much greater number. Matthew 7 seems to indicate that. Jesus says more people in hell than in heaven. But it might have taken that greater number just to reach the smaller but maximal number of people who would freely come to Christ. And in other words, if there's a generation that would be born where no one would be saved from then on in the history of mankind, Jesus will return before that generation comes, okay? Because God, you know, does not desire, you know, He doesn't take pleasure in the death of the wicked, but He desires it, man. He's saved. Yeah. And I think that's the key to the refutation of Calvinism, is the fact that Calvinists are very good at interpreting the Scriptures, except when it comes to passages that talk about God loving all mankind, because the five-point Calvinist has to say God only loves the elect. He doesn't really love all mankind. Jesus didn't die for all mankind. God doesn't desire that all come to repent. He just means all who are going to believe. I mean, they torture those passages. And I think those passages are very, very clear that God is the cosmic lover who calls out to us and sent his Son and proved his love for us by Christ dying on the cross for our sins. And Jesus said, if I be lifted up, if I be crucified, I will draw all men unto myself. It's like the Holy Spirit's got a rope tied to all men, and he's pulling us to himself, but God gives us the freedom to play tug of war with him, or even to take out a machete, blaspheme the Holy Spirit, sever the rope. But whatever the case, I think the Calvinists, there are many Calvinists who are traditional apologists. Even Calvin himself was a traditional apologist. At the same time, I think more consistent Calvinists would be in either the presuppositional or the Phidias camp.
Yeah.
And it's
even hard to believe in that form of faith because of the adjectives used for the believers. I mean, you're a believer.